This episode was created with the support of Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. Visit us at freefm.org.nz.
Now for Gospel and Scripture with Brother Len on Golden Guide.
As the world looks upon me, as I struggle along, they say I have nothing, but they are so wrong. In my heart I'm rejoicing, how I wish they could see. Thank you, Lord, for your blessings on me.
From the people of God, welcome to this program, Golden Guide. The scripture says, there is a way which seem right unto a man, but the end thereof are the ways of death or destruction. From Proverbs chapter 14, verse 12. So therefore, we need the Golden Guide.
Weak nuclear force, electromagnetism and gravity. Which is the strongest? Strong nuclear force. Which is the weakest? Gravity. Do you know the spectrum? If you draw a line with millimeter marks on it, and swing that line across the globe and to the moon and to the sun and across the whole of our Milky Way galaxy, how many millimeter marks would you find on it? And what if you stretched that line to the next galaxy? Boy, we'd lost count completely of the millimeter marks. But those millimeter marks are the number of times that the strong nuclear force is bigger and greater than gravity. All right, impressed. Now, what would happen if we shifted gravity from the 1 millimeter mark to the 2 millimeter mark? Do you know what would happen? This Earth, which is about 7,000 miles in diameter, would get squished to a ball just 40 miles in diameter, and all life would cease. Can you see how finely it is tuned? In other words, gravity has an incomprehensibly narrow range for life to exist. And where are we situated? Between the Sagittarius and Perseus spiral arms of the galaxy. I can't come up with an example of another place in the galaxy as friendly to life as our location. And this position, my friends, is not like sitting on a chair. I'd like to sit here and then a few minutes later, no, I'd like to go there. You can't do that in the galaxy. You're just there, set. And we are in the most friendly part of our galaxy. It is conducive to life. If the universe had not been made with the most exacting precision, we could never have come into existence. Over the past 30 years or so, scientists have discovered that just about everything about the basic structure of the universe is balanced on a razor's edge for life to exist. The seemingly miraculous concurrence of these numerical values must remain the most compelling evidence for cosmic design. There is something going on behind it all. The impression of design is overwhelming. And if that impression is overwhelming, then the idea of design is overwhelming. And therefore, the idea of a designer also should be overwhelming. How about the next one? Logic. Logic requires two parts. The first part is a statement that everyone agrees. It's a statement that is understood to be acceptable to everyone. And on that statement, we make it the base, you have your steps of reasoning. If your basic statement is false and faulty, your conclusion will also be faulty, no matter how well the steps of reasoning have been taken. On the other hand, if your basic premise is okay, but your steps of reasoning are faulty, you will still get up to find a faulty conclusion. So we need both. Here's logical analysis number one. It's called the Kalam cosmological argument. The universe had a beginning. Everyone knows that today. We didn't know it in the science world just in the previous generation. Do you know when they really came to the idea and to the confession that this universe did have a beginning? They finally agreed somewhere in the 1970s. Before that, silence. So it's agreed. This universe had a beginning. Now, in science, any change requires an explanation. If it's going at 5 miles an hour and suddenly 10 miles an hour, then there should be an explanation of the change. If it was going this direction and suddenly began to go this direction, there should be an explanation of that change. And the biggest changes are starting and stopping. So here we have a start. There has to be an explanation. In other words, there has to be a cause. So this universe had a beginning. Whatever begins, it's a big change, the biggest change, it had to have a cause. Therefore, the universe has to have a cause. Logical analysis number two. It's a pan-cosmological argument. The cosmos consists of METS, M-E-T-S, matter, energy, time, space. No effect causes itself. How reasonable do you think it would be if I say this pointer is the cause of the pointer? That wouldn't make much sense. Or this table is the cause of this table. No, no effect causes itself. We could say that the manufacturer was the cause of this pointer. We could say maybe if this was made of wood, we could say that the carpenter was the cause of the table. But the table is not the cause of the table. And if this is made of glass, it is. Nice glass. The glass is not the cause of the table. In other words, even the material that is made up, that makes up the effect or the final product, is not the cause. The cause is distinct. The cause is distinct from its product. Therefore, the cause of the universe is distinct from the universe. Logical analysis number three. It is the order principle, sequence. What comes first? What comes second? All causes produce effects. And all effects have a cause. But here's the order principle. The cause always precedes the effect. So, how do we apply it here? The first cause of the universe preceded the whole universe. Cosmos. M-E-T-S, matter, energy, time, and space. In other words, we cannot appeal to matter, energy, time, and space to be the cause of matter, energy, time, and space. The cause is distinct. How about logical analysis number four? Another order principle of science. A specific corollary of the order principle is the law that while one cause can have many effects, no effect can be quantitatively greater or qualitatively superior to its cause. Yeah, those are big words, I agree. But here's what it's saying simply. If you see me lift up 10 pounds of weight, and if my biceps is the cause of lifting up the 10 pounds, then we can safely conclude that my biceps could generate the force of at least 10 pounds and actually more than that because it overcame gravity as well. So the cause is always at least equal to the effect, many times more. In other words, what we are saying is that the end product or the user, for example, your wallet and mine, will certainly have less money than the bank from where the money came. Your grocery bag and mine will have less vegetables than the grocery store. That's all we are saying. And it's logical. So let's apply it. The universe, our world, our existence has life, thinking, matter, energy, time, space, and the laws of nature. So the cause should have an abundance of life to give you and me, and all the animal life, all the plant life, also should have a giant intellect to be able to impart that to you and me. Also have immense power to give all the power to all the galaxies and the clusters of galaxies we see in the universe. And also have control of all of space and time to harmonize all the laws everywhere. So this cause is pretty impressive and amazing. When Albert Einstein looked at that, this is what he said. His feelings take the form of rapturous amazement at the harmony of natural law, which reveals an intelligence of such superiority that compared with it, all the systematic thinking and acting of human beings is an utterly insignificant reflection. Cause is pretty great. So what's the conclusion from our logical analysis? The universe has a cause. The cause exists distinct from the from nature and the universe. The cause preceded the universe according to the order principle of science. And according to the second order of principle of science, the cause is possibly huge, great, maybe omniscient, omnipresent, and omnipotent. The next one, point, takes into consideration an idea that is an extrapolation, it's a deduction. If there is a God, then the description is that things happened rapidly, quickly. If there is no God, then the description is that the universe came into being very slowly over millions and hundreds of millions and billions of years. So here is an argument that is a deduction of a process that happened quickly. We have to go to what is known as radioisotopes. Some of us don't know what it is. Let me tell you simply what it is. A radioisotope is a substance that gives off radiation. And the radiation comes off itself. So as it gives off the radiation, the mass or the amount of the substance itself comes down. It becomes less. So there is a formula, it's called the half-life. How long does that material take to become half its mass or amount? For example, from 20 to 10. Do you know that that is the exact same period that is required for the mass to go down from 10 to 5? And it is the same period of time that is required to go from 5 to 2.5. And the same from 2.5 to 1.25. In other words, if it halves itself, it has a set period. It's called the half-life of the radioisotope. For example, the uranium-238 has a half-life of 4.53 billion years. And the half-life of these subatomic particles, like the mesons, and the photons, and the baryons, and the bosons, then millionth, hundred millionth of a second. We're looking at one particular radioisotope. It's called polonium-218. Polonium-218 has no precursors. In other words, it does not come from another substance. And its half-life is only 3 minutes. How many minutes? Half-life of polonium-218? 3 minutes. Suppose there's a bubble at the bottom of this glass of water, and it will take 3 minutes for it to climb up to the top, and then it's gone. But I want to hold the bubble. The only way I can hold the bubble is to quickly change the water into ice, and then I would have held the bubble. Agreed? Yes. So here's the question. It will take 3 minutes for the bubble to move from the bottom of the glass to the top, and then it's gone. So if I want to catch the bubble, how quickly should I turn the water into ice? Within 3 minutes. You're right. So if I see a glass of ice, and there's a bubble inside that ice, caught inside there, then I can safely, reasonably deduce that the water was made into ice in 3 minutes or less. Got it? Yes. There are different types of rock that we come across. Igneous rock comes out from lava. Metamorphic rock that changes. Sedimentary rock. The material is brought and pressed down over a long period of time, becomes rock. There's another rock which is very peculiar. It is granite. Granite is a rock that we have not yet deduced or understood how it was formed. We know the composition. We know possibly the pressure and the temperature which must be applied to the composition to make it into granite. But whenever it is tried, it never forms granite. It forms another powdery substance. But here's the point. Every granite piece in the world, every, that has been studied, from the El Capitan in Yosemite National Park to maybe even the Rock of Gibraltar or any other place on Earth, has polonium halos in them, not by just a few or handful, by the thousands. Polonium halos are what is caused when the radiation is given off. So when polonium-218 gives off its radiation, it forms a halo signature. So if we found halo signature in a granite rock, we can make a reasonable deduction that that granite piece was formed in 3 minutes. And if every piece of granite has polonium halos, then we can deduce that the granite, which forms basically the crust of the earth, was formed in 3 minutes, which half-life, the full life is say about 5 hours, 3 minutes to 5 hours, half a day of the daylight time. Not millions and hundreds of millions and billions of years. So, the polonium halos could be a pointer to God. The polonium halos, unrefuted evidence for the Earth's instant creation. An exceedingly large number of polonium halos are embedded in granites around the world, which distinctly implies that our Earth was formed in a very short time. I spoke to the person who did this study. His name is Robert Gentry, and this is what he said. We have repeatedly challenged the Academy, which is the National Academy of Sciences, to publicly explain where the polonium halo evidence for creation has ever been scientifically invalidated. For over 15 years, they have refused to even try. And this is when I had asked him 5 years ago. So at least 20 years have gone by, and nobody has refuted that piece of evidence. So as long as it's not refuted, it could point to a rapid process, which would be more like God in existence than like atheism. Column 4 is the final column. In this, we have arguments against atheism. Why would we say we will not possibly accept atheism? And here are the points. Number 1, it disallows evidence. Number 2, its fundamental premise is flawed. Number 3, it has to claim that the universe came from absolutely nothing. And number 4, we make a statistical analysis. Let's look at all 4 of them. It disallows evidence. Why? Let your mind now think. Let the wheels turn. There cannot be evidence for that which has never existed. Got it? There cannot be existence for anything that has never existed. For example, if aeroplanes never existed, then no matter how many propellers or jet engines you find, no matter how many cockpits or fuselages or seat belts you find, it cannot be evidence for an aeroplane. It could be evidence maybe for a yacht or a speedboat or maybe even a submarine, not an aeroplane, because the aeroplanes simply don't exist. Got it? Simple. In other words, atheism is a conclusion prior to the inquiry, and this inquiry disallows any evidence for consideration. Once you say that there is no God in existence, you have moved away from any evidence that could possibly be brought. Because any evidence is now no longer for God. It's for something else. So it disallows evidence. The moment you state it and make a hypothesis, you have knocked off the evidence. Therefore, a process that does not like evidence is not scientific. Number two, the fundamental premise. The fundamental claim of atheism we saw right in the beginning was that it is a reasonable scientific claim. But let's ask science what it says. Here's a statement from the US National Academy of Sciences. Science can say nothing about the supernatural. Whether God exists or not is a question about which science is neutral. It is limited to explaining the natural world through natural causes. So much for that claim. In other words, the claim is simply non-existent. The base which it says was science is not there. The philosophy of science could possibly be pulled in that direction, but even that fails. What's the philosophy of science? The philosophy of science states that science as a discipline will only look for natural causes to natural phenomena. It will never appeal to the supernatural. That's the philosophy. In other words, the supernatural is outside its study. So what is science doing? It is excluding the study of the supernatural. And if you have excluded the study, you have not excluded the existence. You have only excluded the study. In no way can science ever prove the non-existence of God. And here I make a dictum, a statement. Nothing in the natural world, nothing at all, can ever disprove the existence of God. So its fundamental premise, it is flawed. Origin. Absolutely nothing. See, if there is no God, then the only option is that the universe came from absolutely nothing. And I'm not saying that. Look at the statements on the screen. So from nothing our universe begins. So where did the laws of nature come from? They came from nothing. The void out of which the universe spontaneously arose. How about the last statement on the screen? The only reasonable belief is that we came from nothing, by nothing, and for nothing. I mean, it's a, I guess, a borrowing from the Gettysburg Address. Wide, sweeping statement. So I had to ask, what is it based on? Nothing. Just a mere opinion. And we said we were not going to give just an opinion any weight. It's an opinion. But let's look at this nothingness a little closely. Let's look at it physically. And we'll build the Sears Tower. Or in Toronto, it'll be the CN Tower. Let's build the tower. But I'm not going to give you any material and no builder, no time, no space. I'm not even going to give you yourself. And if you are going to get ready to complain to me that you're not giving me any of these things, then let me confess to you, even I'm not in existence. Oh boy, now how are we going to build the Sears Tower and the CN Towers? Doesn't make good sense, right? In other words, absolute nothingness as a starting point is physically totally impractical. How about philosophically? Absolute nothingness cannot be imagined. Why do we say that? Because to imagine, you have to use your brain and mind. And you cannot imagine the non-existence of something that you are using. That's not possible. If you bang a nail into the wood with a hammer, you cannot afterward postulate the non-existence of the hammer. Then how did the nail go in? You know what I'm saying? If you cannot imagine it, and it's impossible to imagine that which you are using, because if you want to say absolute nothingness, you must imagine the non-existence of your own brain and mind. That cannot be possible. That which cannot be imagined cannot be proposed as a scientific theory because there's no starting point to make or even to evaluate the theory. So philosophically, absolute nothingness as a starting point is an impossibility. How about scientifically? Look at what is stated by the scientists. And remember, I said, don't get overwhelmed because a great scientist had said so. Go ahead and look at it and examine it. Here's what they say. Quantum mechanical fluctuations in the vacuum created the universe. By the laws of physics, nothingness is unstable. How about the statement that we all know, nature abhors vacuum? You know, scientifically, when you look at this, there's a mix-up of the void, which is total, absolute nothingness, and vacuum. They are two different things. Just look at nature. Vacuum? Do you know how you can get vacuum in nature? It is not just nothingness. Vacuum is a state only because the nothingness is surrounded by something. It's a physical barrier. If you take away the barrier, you will not have nothing. You will have stuff going inside there. So a vacuum requires something to be a vacuum. So where is the pressure and the strength of the force? They will tell you that it's in the vacuum, but it really is not. The strength of that system is actually in the pressure that's outside the vacuum. It's very easy to check it out. Take a flask, pull out all, suck out all the air, and you have a vacuum inside there. Now, if you poke a hole on the side of the flask, you'll immediately know that the vacuum is an unstable entity. Air gets inside there. But where was the strength? Was it in the nothingness or in the something that was outside? In the air molecules, in the atmospheric pressure that was on the outside? You know, we can check this out so simply. Let's take this initial vacuum, which is in the flask, and put this flask in another bigger flask. And let's pull out the air from the bigger flask so that the bigger flask now has a vacuum inside it. So here is a smaller flask with nothing inside it and a bigger flask also with nothing except the smaller flask, of course. Now, if we poke a hole in the smaller flask, what will happen? Absolutely nothing. There's no whoosh like we saw in the previous one. Why? Because there's nothing surrounding it. There is no atmospheric pressure, no air molecule surrounding it. In other words, here's the conclusion. Nothing that is surrounded by nothing, that is surrounded by nothing, that is surrounded by nothing to an infinite degree is infinitely stable. This question of laws of physics in which nothingness is unstable is only applicable to the state of vacuum, not to the state of absolute nothingness. By the way, you look at that statement, by the laws of physics. You're appealing to the laws of physics which were not even available at that point. So, scientifically, nothingness at the starting point is untenable. How about mathematically? Science, especially physics, may be represented as common sense wrapped in mathematics. You know, when you make a physics statement, it will not be acceptable until you have a mathematical formula to go along with it. You can't just say gravity. It is related to the masses of these two bodies and also to the inverse of the square of the distance between the two bodies. So you see, there's a mathematical formula. So science is common sense wrapped in mathematics. So let's use that idea and apply it to our question. Let's make a statement that could possibly be made into a mathematical formula. Here are the statements. Atheistic proposal says, nothing did nothing about nothing and produced everything. How about the theistic proposal? Someone did something about the nothing and produced the universe. So take these statements and make it into an equation. Here's what the equation looks like. 0 plus 0 plus 0 is equal to 100. How reasonable can that be? And theism says x plus y plus 0 is equal to 100. Now you can look immediately and see that the theistic proposal, which has numbers, could have a chance of reaching 100. If you start with zero, you will end up with only zero. You know, a few years ago, I was talking to a postdoctoral fellow in mathematics, and I asked him this. I said, 2 minus 2 is arrow 0. 2 minus 2 ends up with 0. Can you turn it around and say 0 lands up with 2 minus 2? He thought for a moment and he said, interesting question, but no, you can't come up to 2 minus 2 because there's an infinite numbers of options over here. 100 minus 100, half minus half, 0.2 minus 0.2. The only way, if you start with a number, with zero, and have this equation which ends in numbers, is to have at least one number on this side of the arrow. In other words, if you start with only zero, you'll end up with zero. To have any other option, you will have to supply a number. So what are we saying? Zeros, no matter how many, will end up with only zero. Let's put 5 zeros in a row. How much is that? Zero. Now what you do is put a 1 on the left side of these 5 zeros and see what happens to that number. What are we saying? Zeros by itself is only zero. It requires a number to make it into anything. So, absolute nothingness is mathematically worse than absurdity. I have here a book. It is written by a theoretical physicist. And here's the title: A Universe from Nothing. Can you see the big letters, nothing? You know, the first few pages are endorsements of the book by prestigious people. Like I said, don't be overwhelmed by PhDs and doctorate degrees. Look at what they are saying. And in these endorsements are the statements that I found. In this nothingness, there are many wonderful things to see. In the nothingness, wonderful things to see. How about Neil deGrasse, who is an astrophysicist? This is what he said in the endorsement. Nothing is not nothing. Nothing is something. So much for the title of the book, my friends. Can you see that even though you may be a big scientist, you are misleading? This title is quite misleading. In other words, actually, it is false. But look at the endorsement given in the afterword by Richard Dawkins, who is arguably one of the most vocal atheists in the world today. And this is what he said in his ending. The title means exactly what it says. And I say the title means exactly what it does not say. Or rather, it does not say the truth of the matter. The universe could never have come from nothing. What they really mean, if you read the book, is that the nothing does not mean nothing. It just means pure radiation. But that's what the entire universe came from. So it's not nothing, it's everything. Statement, title, false. Absolute nothingness is physically impractical, philosophically an impossibility, scientifically untenable and actually scientific, and mathematically worse than absurdity. Here's the aphorism that I was talking about. Ex nihilo nihil fit. Out of nothing, nothing comes. The difficulties of belief may be great. The absurdities of unbelief are greater. How about the last one? Statistical analysis. You know, chance is subjective. What's the chance of this happening? What's the chance of that happening? But it's also a mathematical concept, and it's called probability. It's a very specific formula. You plug in the numbers, and it comes out. These are the chances. 1 is to 10, 1 is to 100, 1 is to 1,000. I'm going to state some numbers, and they are actually arbitrary numbers. And I agree they are arbitrary, but don't look at the actual numbers, look at the trend of the numbers. For example, if there is something that will happen 10 to the power of 8 times, which is 100 million times, in the circumstances, it will always happen, and only once it will not happen, then in day-to-day life we say it will happen. If it will happen only once and will not happen 100 million times, then we say it will not, it's not going to happen. In scientific evaluation, the number goes up to 10 to the power of 15, 1 quadrillion. This is the number that scientists have to use when they construct anything that has a risk of life and limb. For example, a suspension bridge. Then the angles at which they put the girders, the strength of the cable, these have to be tested to mathematically to 10 to the power of 15 times. Then they can use it. In other words, safe. 10 to the power of 15 times it will occur, once it will not occur, fact. If it will occur only once, will not occur 10 to the power of 15 times, not possible. Now when you state a law, the number goes up to 50. 50 is 1 followed by 50 zeros. That's a big number. In fact, actually it's going over our heads, right? It goes over my head too. Let me give you an idea of what we mean by these numbers. But these numbers are not exact, remember? They're arbitrary numbers, but let me give you an idea of what the number is. If I am testing the law of gravity once per second, I am looking for that one chance in which this pointer will not come down, but will just stay there when I leave it or float away. I'm looking for that one chance, and I'm doing it once per second. You know, to do it 10 to the power of 18 times will require 15 billion years. To do it 10 to the power of 20 times will take me 1.5 trillion years. And why the 15 billion years? It's the approximate age of the entire universe. So if, let's say there are 10 billion of us on this earth. If all 10 billion of us did this every day without a break, from the time the universe began up to now, we would have reached only 10 to the power of 28 times. So what am I saying? 10 to the power of 50 is a huge number. Fair enough? Yes, it is. So, one chance occurrence, 10 to the power of 50 chances non-occurrence, is an utter impossibility statistically. Let's apply that. So Michael Denton was the first one to actually challenge the idea of the origin of life according to the theory of evolution. The initial cell to be viable would require at least 100 functional proteins. So what are the chances that we could get 100 proteins at the same point, at the same time, and form that cell? His calculation showed a chance of only 1 in 10 to the power of 2,000. That's a huge number. And remember, 10 to the power of 51 is a number that is 10 times bigger than 10 to the power of 50. So where is 10 to the power of 2,000? Suppose we address Sir Michael Denton and say, look, I'm not very sure whether you did it right. I think your number is wrong. It should be brought down by half. No, not by half. 1/10. No, 1/100. No, you made a big mistake, Sir Michael Denton. Your number should come down by a factor of 100 billion. You made a big mistake. So, okay. What is 10 to the power of 2,000 divided by 100 billion? Remember, we are trying to bring it down to 10 to the power of 50 so that we can have a say in the matter. You know what is 10 to the power of 2,000 divided by 100 billion? It is 10 to the power of 1,989. 10 to the power of 50, nowhere in sight. So these numbers are so big. They are arbitrary, but they are so big that you cannot really question them. How about the next one? You know, these proteins are made up of amino acids. Amino acids are little building blocks, and you have to have them in a chain. Amino acids have left-handed links, right-handed links. When people manufacture amino acids in the laboratory, you always get what is known as a racemic mixture, meaning 50% right-handed, 50% left-handed, and we know of no way of changing those numbers. It is always a racemic mixture, 50%, 50%. But inside that cell, all the amino acids, and we need 10,000 amino acids to make the 100 proteins, all 10,000 amino acids must be only left-handed. And in the chromosome, which is in the nucleus, the chromosome is made up of nucleotides. We need 100,000 nucleotides to form that chromosomal chain. And in the cell, all 100 nucleotides have to be only right-handed. So what are the chances that we are going to get 10,000 left-handed amino acids and 100,000 right-handed nucleotides at the same point in time and space to form that cell? Here's what one person says who calculated it. According to him, it says there's only one chance in 33,113. Are you impressed? Are you willing to say wow? I was willing to say wow. But just in case you are not, let me try once more. There is a person whose name is Harold Morowitz. He calculated the chances of all the components of the cell coming together, all. Cell wall, cell membrane, cytoplasm, Golgi apparatus, mitochondria, everything. What are the chances that one single cell would be formed? Do you know how many cells are there in your body and mine? Anywhere from 60 to 75 trillion. But here we're talking only about one, the original one. What are the chances that we get all the components together at one point? Here is a statistical chance. 1 in 10 to the power of 100 billion. And that is just to bring the stuff together. You got to teach each one what to do. That's not in this number. And then we got to teach them how to divide. The cell must divide. And once the cell divides, both of them must be still alive. How does that happen? You got to teach that. That's not in the number. Then when it becomes more complex and more complex, then plant life, animal life, then human life, and then somewhere along the line was injected into this complex organism an appreciation for friendship, for loyalty, for love. Can you see the list really is endless? If the list is endless, what are the chances of it occurring? If only two possibilities exist, and there are only two, atheism and theism, and if only one is correct, then if A is possible, so is B. But if A becomes improbable, B will become probable. And if A becomes impossible, B becomes fact. Really? Let's check it out. First, a lecture on mathematics. And here's the lecture. 6 minus 3 is equal to 3. Now, when you look at the first number and the last one, when there's a subtraction sign, the last number is always smaller than the first number, if there's a subtraction sign. In other words, a number minus another number, the product or the end will always be smaller than the first number. That is our mathematical lecture. Over. Now time for the test. So I'm going to give you a test. But here's how I'm going to do it. I'm going to give you a problem to solve, and then I will give you the answers. Two answers. Only two. One of them is correct. Got it? The lecture says that a number subtract from which another number is subtracted will end up with a number that is smaller than the first number. Here it is. The problem. What is 11 minus 6. And I'm going to give you two options. The first option is 19. And the second option, I've written it down, but I'm not going to show it to you. So option A is 19, option B is hidden. Which one will you choose? Option B, of course. Why? Because option A is bigger than the first number, and it is impossible. Once you have a negative sign, subtraction sign, for the number to be bigger. And therefore, the other option is the correct one. Did you get it? You don't have to see it to know that it is correct. You don't have to see it. If you show this to be impossible, then the other becomes fact. People say, why can't we see? Fine, but if statistically it's impossible, then this is fact. In other words, if it is statistically, utterly, totally, completely impossible for the first cell to have gotten together by itself, then the only reasonable scientific conclusion is that somebody supervised it. It didn't do it by itself. So here's what we come up with then. A word from Sherlock Holmes, the super detective of the previous age. How often have I said to you that when you have eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth? Have we made our points? Column number 1, 0. Column number 2, 20. Column number 3, which we said was, you know, the circumstantial evidence, the anthropic principle, the logical analysis, and the question of the granite formation. How many points would you give it? I'd say I'd give it 80, because there's nothing that hits against those points. How many points would you give this last column number 4? The strength of the arguments. From nothing, we saw it was strong. Statistical analysis strong. In other words, I'd say it'll be close to 100, but let's make it 80. So here's the summary of the PAN process. Column number 1, 0. Column number 2, 20. Column number 3, 80. And column number 4, 80. Now let's put it together, because atheism is columns 1 and 4. And what you got to do is put a negative sign on the column 4 and shift it over to the other side, because you're taking it to the other side. So you have to have a minus. These are points against atheism. So atheism is 0 minus 80, which lands up minus 80. Theism is 80 minus, which is column 3, minus the 20 in column 2. 60. Look at the strength of these numbers. It doesn't matter what the numbers are. You could have put your own numbers, but you do not have the numbers on the same side of plus and minus. It is not that theism is, say, 30 and atheism is 40 or 20. It is theism being on the positive side. So it wins not by a small margin, it wins completely, because the other side is negative. And a negative cannot stand before a positive number. So mathematically, we have shown something here, my friends. In other words, the final conclusions, options. Theism is difficult to believe. No question about it. We do have a hard time. But look at the options we have. Agnosticism is totally impractical and unreal. And atheism is baseless and absurd. So yes, if we take the stand that theism is a bad decision, then I'm suggesting to you that the alternatives are worse and worst. Therefore, the bad decision is a good decision. Agreed? You can break it down if you want, all my arguments. You can come with a Q&A period later on. So here's my conclusion. Based on evidence and reasonable logical thinking, the existence of the supernatural is valid and makes the better sense. Therefore, the existence of God is a rational, credible claim. If I were an attorney, a lawyer, in a court case, I would turn to you as members of the jury and I'd say, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, here are my arguments. I rest my case. Thank you.
Is there a power in this world
that can keep me from loving you.
From the mighty to the small, the glory in them all is God's and God's alone. God and God alone reveals the truth of all we call unknown. And all the best and worst of men won't change the Master's plan. It's God's and God's alone. God and God alone is fit to take the universe's throne. Let everything that lives reserve its truest praise. For God and God alone. God and God alone will be the joy.
I invite you to listen this program, Golden Time, and the Power of Truth, here on Free FM 89.0, with me, Brother Lynn Fletcher, every Sunday at 6 until 7 o'clock in the evening. And thanks for your listening.
This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.